accountability for that. That when I see something or hear something, I don't lay dormant or silent. I step and speak to correct it. And that's some real work.
Susan Burton's voice sounds the twin resolve of a woman devoted to hands-on service and to movement leadership. Her example and the spirit of her work at A New Way of Life illustrate one of the most central and potent themes of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. Tinkering with the criminal justice machine, she argues, will never be enough to end mass incarceration. Cost-benefit reforms and piecemeal policy changes are not a foundation for truly transformational and structural change. On the contrary, a spiritual turning, a new embodiment of care, compassion, and concern in our society, is what Alexander argues is necessary. The simple yet profoundly challenging realization that we, each and all of us, belong to one another. Susan Burton and the women of A New Way of Life give us a picture of what that might look like.
You know, it's beautiful. I watch them going to school. I watch them with their children. I watch them with their disappointment. I watch them come in and say, you know, it worked, Miss Burton. Or it worked, Mama Sue. I got into school today. What you told me worked. And it's beautiful.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. A New Way of Life and the New Underground Railroad was produced by Chris Moore Backman and is part of the radio documentary series Bringing Down the New Jim Crow. The music in this show included The Moment I Need You and Blackout by Stray Theories and Calm Down by Loney Deer. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 510-251-1332, extension 108, or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
The time is 6:31, almost 6:32. We hope you enjoyed listening to Making Contact. Coming up right next, we have the debut episode of Free Culture Radio. That'll be coming your way in just about 10 seconds.
Hello, and welcome to the premiere edition of Free Culture Radio. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. KBOO.FM on the web. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the inescapable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being drug users. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when drug users are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. On this, the first installment of Free Culture Radio, we're going to talk about, well, what we're going to be talking about. Before we can really look at drug culture and the influence of drugs on society, there are some basic questions that have to be answered. We have to get the lowdown, as it were. Take a 40,000-foot view. When I was putting the show together, I spoke with a good friend. His name is Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and directs their drug policy project.
We have created a false dichotomy. This is one of the great vanities of the Western conceit of categorizing things in such a way that drugs are what other people do. Food and medicine, that's what we consume. You know, those foreigners, they do that strange thing, that those are drugs and those must be banned, until we incorporate them or find ways to incorporate them into our own culture. So that this permeates human evolution. If you think about what caused humans to migrate and to trade over vast distances. You know, when you have things like the Silk Road and the Roman Empire and their fleets of ships, they were moving lots of goods. Why? What kind of goods? Well, people basically have their staples, you know, staple foods, you know, in their immediate environment. It's the luxury goods and the exotic goods and the mind-altering goods that are the ones that humans will travel, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of miles to go seek out and bring back. And so that drove a lot of human migration and exploration and colonization to the point where, you know, Columbus, when he set out to go look for the quote-unquote New World, he was after primarily spices, right? Not so much gold and God and colonization, but he thought it was the spice route. That's what he was after to the Indies. And why was Columbus interested in spices back then? It wasn't just that the food in Europe was bland and awful and tasteless, which it was, but each new spice was thought to have exotic properties, and exotic, but in the sense that this was the Viagra of the day, right? And of course, most of these aphrodisiacs are all in your head anyway, and so it worked for a lot of people, and so these spices became very, very, very valuable. That's how, you know, drugs permeate our history and our culture. Not only did Columbus do that to go, you know, look for these spices, but when he bumped into the New World and colonized and enslaved, you know, he produced what were the original crops? What were the original, you know, sources of wealth in the New World besides gold? It was these crops. It was coffee. It was tobacco. It was tea. It was spices. It was rum, from which sugar came from, and sugar itself being a drug. And so drugs fueled the colonial development of this hemisphere. It would not have been the same without it, could not have been the same without it. If you look at the history of Virginia or Kentucky, you know, imagine if there had been no tobacco. How would our country have evolved? If you look at the American Revolution, Barbados, the island of Barbados was worth more to the British Empire than the 13 colonies in North America because of sugar. That's where the rum and the sugar came from. You know, and so we place a great wealth, and it fueled the banking empires of Europe. It built a lot of European societies and their wealth, which gave them, you know, centuries-long head start relative to the rest of the world. So these things are world-shaping kinds of phenomena. It's particularly Western science after the Enlightenment, you know, began. We became too clever in the sense that we understood how things worked. We began to tinker and take things apart and analyze things, you know, independent of the larger cultural and environmental, you know, framework. And so we began classifying things, classifying plants, for instance. And when these UN treaties are created in the 1960s and, you know, and onwards, these Western scientists would go around the world and look at different plants. And if they didn't use them, if it wasn't part of their culture, those were classified as drugs, things like coca. But if you surveyed your listeners, almost all of them are just a few generations away from a fundamentally different understanding of plants and drugs. And what I mean by that is that if you go back a century, you know, two or three centuries, there were no drug stores, right? There was no pharmacies. Your pharmacy was your backyard. It was your garden. It was your forest. It was your jungle. And people, your ancestors, had very intimate knowledge of which plants did what. And their folk medicine was actually quite effective. And so much so that, you know, when modern medicine and the doctors became, you know, first started becoming powerful, they went after a lot of these folk healers. Saying that's hocus pocus, that's mumbo jumbo. And in fact, if you go to Appalachia and look at some of those studies from, you know, a century and a half ago, the people practicing folks medicine, mostly women, had better health outcomes than doctors of their era. So and go back historically to England, for instance, when Christianity began to take hold, the women who understood how plant medicines worked were persecuted as witches. Right. So that knowledge has been suppressed, and our culture has driven it far underground. We're only finally beginning to discover. You'll see articles all over, you know, the internet about, oh, your spice rack contains all these drugs. Did you know that these, you know, have medicinal properties? Of course they, you know, we knew. We just choose to bury that and to forget it. And so now we've created this false dichotomy, this conceit that you know, you go to the Safeway, to the supermarket for your food, and you go to the CVS or the drugstore for your medicine. Your ancestors made no such distinction. And if you go to traditional doctors in China and India and other parts of the world where they have, you know, 5,000 years of recorded observations about plants and their properties, this is a very natural thing. They understand that, you know, you don't need to necessarily isolate the exact compound from a plant to purify it, make it a pill that some corporation can patent, but that these plants have very predictable and useful purposes in medicine. And so if you go to a traditional Chinese doctor, very often the first thing they'll recommend is a change in diet before they recommend any pills or Western style medicine, because traditional peoples and all humans, really, ancestrally speaking, understood that certain plants had certain properties. Some were mild medicinal properties, some were very potent, some were psychoactive. But because of these Western scientists going around categorizing these things for these UN treaties, a lot of indigenous peoples are now persecuted or even, you know, being prosecuted for using traditional medicines that their ancestors have used for countless generations very effectively. So things like ayahuasca, for instance, you know, in the Amazon, the very powerful hallucinogen and entheogen, used spiritually and in terms of mental health for centuries. And can you imagine some UN bureaucrat, drug warrior saying, no, that's banned. You can't do that now. You must instead go seek out a Freudian shrink and go sit on the couch and tell them, you know, about your obsession with cigars or something. That is so culturally crazy and inappropriate. And it takes away something that they've used for a long time and used well.
In some South American countries where it's produced, coca is also legally available. Coca candies and such, coca leaf. People chew coca leaf. Mm-hmm. Do they use coca and coffee in similar ways, or is that or are they very distinct as far as the uses? Like I say, down in the Andes.
They're both mild and safe stimulants. And so in places like Bolivia or Peru, where there was a long history of coca consumption, coca leaf in its natural form, the class distinctions are interesting. So you'll have the average citizens and campesinos chewing coca leaf. But the rich people will also consume coca leaf, but they'll take it in tea form in their silver tea service, right? So... That's the class stratification there. But they're both very safe and mild stimulants, and they're very useful for adjusting to altitude sickness. So the U.S. Embassy's own website in La Paz, Bolivia, used to recommend to travelers who landed there, because you're 2.5 miles above sea level, basically, with 40% of the available oxygen of sea level, to consume coca tea. It's a no-brainer. Otherwise, you end up with, you know, incredible fatigue. Just walking, you know, up a flight of stairs, you need to lie down after that. And you get a terrible altitude headache, and that could last, you know, 2 days. So the coca makes it much more tolerable.
So the poorer folks just eat the stuff raw. The wealthier will have it in the tea, but it's all a
Yeah. And in Bolivia, where there is now a large legal traditional coca leaf market, they're encouraging and experimenting with all kinds of new preparations. So coca flour, which has been around for a while. They take the leaves and grind it up into flour and mix it with regular flour to make cakes and cookies. It's a very good source of protein, vitamins, iron, lots of other nutrients. And it's mildly, and I underscore mildly, stimulating. Coffee, in my opinion, is far more stimulating than coca in its natural form. Huh. But that's just me.
So what do you think about the idea for a show like Free Culture Radio? Do you think this, do you think this fills an actual necessary niche?
Absolutely. It's about connecting the dots and getting the bigger picture, you know, the perspective of 40,000 feet or 8 miles high, as the birds called it. Then you begin to see the larger outlines and contours of this thing we call drugs or the drug war or you know, and how they mesh into our culture. It's hard to see at the micro level, right? And until you back up enough to begin to take a look at your own history and your own evolution from Columbus to, you know, Timothy O'Leary.
That was from a conversation with Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs their drug policy project. You are listening to Free Culture Radio on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, obviously, over the coming months, we're going to be talking about some serious stuff. So when I was putting this concept together, I got some serious advice.
Well, yeah, man. I mean, cats talk about that all the time, right? Bill Hicks talks about, you know, if you don't like drugs, burn all your Beatles albums, right? There's that book, what was it, Food of the Gods, discussing magic mushrooms and the evolution of man. Steve Jobs talks about how taking acid helped him with some design ideas and all kind of ideas. And what's that guy's name? Alex Gray. He's also one of those guys, right? That whole Maps thing. I mean, when you think about a lot of the things, I mean, you know, war was probably invented by someone on crank. So, but
that's Ngaio Bilam. He's a social justice activist, a comedian, and a writer.
Like I say, the idea is to talk about this. I'm not trying to encourage people to do anything.
No.
That's the point. I mean, I'm not up here to discourage people from doing something either. I mean, and we're talking about all drugs too.
It's a personal thing, right? Like, I'm 48. I smoke weed almost every day. I do mushrooms every once in a while. That's it, right? You know, I have a drink every once in a while, but I don't hardly ever get drunk. Never done coke, never done acid, never done Molly, never done any of those other things, you know? And that's just it's a personal choice. It's not that I haven't had the opportunity. I'm saving opium for when I'm older. And that's the thing. And, you know, this whole idea of prohibiting drugs is just really turning otherwise creative and responsible citizens into criminals. And that's not good for anybody. We do ourselves a disservice.
The idea is to talk about everything from coffee to cocaine, from marijuana to meth, to from hops to heroin. It's
I think that's a great idea. I mean, drugs. You know, there's never been a time when people didn't do drugs. You know what I'm saying? Never once. Never been a time.
Although There is a thing to the denial, I think, and that's part of the reason I wanted to do this, is the idea, you mentioned, you know, you don't drink. You meant you don't use alcohol, right?
Hardly ever.
Yeah, but we don't even say the word. It's, you know, it's just like a nudge, like, you know, drink, wink, wink. And it's like, it's...
Right, we don't say use alcohol, as you say, I smoke weed or I do cocaine. Right, you say you just have a drink.
Yeah, I mean, that's the...
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I always wonder what that does, sort of normalizing, it's normalizing a behavior, but is it doing it in a good way, or is it a touch of denial, you know? That's the...
You know, it's just a euphemism, right? I mean, you know, there was a time, I mean, there still is some time when you ask someone, do you smoke, or do you mind if I smoke? And then they go, well, do you smoke what? You know what I'm saying? Do I smoke tobacco? Do I smoke marijuana? Do I smoke meth? Do I smoke heroin? Like, there's a lot of things. It used to just be assumed that it was tobacco, and now you have to ask. So I don't, you know, that's an issue. I mean, alcohol is such an ingrained part of American life, even though we don't drink nearly as much as people think we do. When you look at it globally on a per capita basis, I mean, the Eastern Europeans got us beat by a lot. The Swedes love to drink. Compared to the alcohol consumption rates in America, which is funny when you see all the drunk people in a park every Friday. Can you imagine? We're like 19th in the world. You know, it's just an interesting thing to me about that.
Years ago, some people I know made waves by creating some literature about drug consumer safety. The idea being that people use substances of various sorts, and so they should learn to use them in a safe, responsible manner. And they got flack from some of the prohibitionists. It was amazing.
Yeah, Jocelyn Elders also got fired for suggesting that maybe teenagers should know about self-pleasure in a sex education class, so that perhaps they can maybe stave off their overwhelming evolutionary urge to have sex. You know what I'm saying? Like, prohibition is, never the answer. Of course you want people. I mean, my daughter's going to college. I don't think we haven't had a talk about all kind of drugs and effects and what to look out for and what to do. Education is always a better answer than prohibition. You're just creating a taboo. And I don't know if you've ever hung out with Americans. When you tell them they can't do something, that's when they want to go out and do it. That's how we are. It's been ingrained in us for a long time, the idea of the rebel, you know, the anti-authoritarian. So if you remove the glory and you discuss it in concrete and object ways, you have a better chance of keeping people from at least abusing them. You know, there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population that wants to experiment with anything. I mean, that's how you get innovation, is cats try to go farther than someone's gone before. Doesn't always work out, but a lot of times it works out in different and mysterious and fantastic ways.
You mentioned that you've already had that talk with your daughter who's about to go off to college.
Yes.
You've been watching the news, I presume, in the last week or so, and you've seen another man's daughter who was at a music festival. Someone who should probably have realized, who must have been aware that she literally lives in the camera lens.
Oh, you know, listen, man, she's 18. Who was it? What was his name? Zach? Oh, dang it. He was on the TV show Scrubs. But anyway, the point is, he put out a tweet that said, "Try to find a picture of me when I was 18 where I was not high." You understand? She's going to a very good college. She's a straight A student. She's at a music festival. I go to music festivals and smoke weed. I'm 48 years old. So, like, what is the big deal? It's not a big deal. She, you know, I would rather she do, you know, if she was crazy. I mean, like, how many, if she was crazy drunk, that would also be a scandal. Smoking a joint, though, there's no problem. You see what I'm saying? How many times were the Bush twins arrested, or how many times did they get in trouble for underage drinking in Texas bars? This is what teenagers do. They're out there trying to learn things, trying to individuate themselves. Everybody here went underage drinking. Everybody over the age of 21 had drinks before they were 21, right? So, like I say in my act, all the bars in my neighborhood were surprised on my 21st birthday.
I'm wondering if she meant that as if she really meant that. To sort of like, this is not really a big deal.
It through because she's 18. It's not occurring to her. It's like, oh, yeah, man, I'm at this music festival. I'm going to hit this joint. I'm going to dance. Like, Michael Phelps was 19 when they got that picture of him smoking weed. People forget. Like, when you grow up with cameras around you all the time, you forget the cameras are around you all the time, right, which is what other people count on. You and I are of a different generation, so you can still find a camera. You still worry about being caught on film or on tape doing something that maybe, even if it's something that you're perfectly within your right to do, you worry about the optics of it. These kids, man, it's harder to worry about the optics because cameras are omnipresent, right? Privacy is not a sham, but it's kind of a thing of the past, right? Something is always watching you. That's just how it is. That's not a paranoid thing. That's just the truth, right? You think cops would learn that first and start acting better, but what are you going to do?
Which, when you get down to it, is all the more reason to repeal these foolish prohibitions, because they're...
You're going to have to.
Yeah. It's even more arbitrary.
You're going to have to. Everybody's going to have to become a little more tolerant of things because it's, you know, no one respects anyone's privacy, right? The people who took those videos did not have to post them to the internet. You could have just showed them to your friends, right? Here's Malia smoking weed. That's cool. Ryan, here's a picture I got. You don't have to post things. No one's forcing you to post some things. Is it really relevant to the national conversation that someone's 18-year-old daughter is smoking weed at a concert? Is that a threat to national security? Is that going to affect someone? Is that going to affect someone's job program? No. So why are people worrying about it?
And that is, that's the million-dollar question.
It's called concern trolling.
Yeah.
Right, when you troll someone in the guise of being worried about them, well, I just worry that you're smoking weed at 18 because yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, I am Kyle, thank you. It's been
thank you, brother.
been good conversation. Like I say, let's move forward with this show. We need to figure out how to present these ideas and what kind of ideas that need presenting. This is.
Are you going to break each show into maybe a different category? Today we're going to.
Yeah, themed discussions.
So I mean, these are the things we want to talk about. I mean, we're doing this. If you want fewer people to use drugs, prohibition is not the way to do it, right? Education, rehabilitation, safety. These are the things. We talk about harm reduction. We talk about what's going to help the most amount of people. These are the things. But, you know, it all goes deep. And then you have to get into private prisons. And anyway.
That was from a conversation with Ngayo Bilom. He's a social justice activist and comedian who writes for the Sacramento, California News and Review. You are listening to Free Culture Radio on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I still needed to dig more deeply to prepare for all this, so I reached out to a friend for some historical perspective. Rick Doblin is the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS for short. He got his PhD in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, where he also picked up his master's.
What do you think? I mean, what kind of influence do you think drugs have had on society? Do you think it's a minor thing? Is it an aberration? Or give me your thoughts.
Well, the aberration is prohibition. And in the history of the world, you know, there's been very few years, actually, of prohibition. I mean, there is certain religions that are against alcohol. There's the Mormons that are against certain drugs. But drugs, in particular, marijuana and psychedelic drugs, opiates for pain medication, coca leaves, have had a profound influence on cultures. People have always looked at the plant kingdom and other places for food, but also for drugs that will both, you know, cure diseases and stimulate certain kind of thinking. And if we talk about Western culture, which is, you know, where we grew up and where we're living now, and we look back to the origins of Western culture, the longest running mystery ceremonies that we're aware of in the entire world were the Eleusinian Mysteries. And they ran from around 1600 BC to around 396 AD. They were eventually wiped out by the Catholic Church. But they were mystery ceremonies that involved taking a potion called kikion. And Albert Hoffman and others have looked into it, and they believe that it was an LSD-like substance that was ergot, from which LSD is derived and then slightly modified, that it was a potion that was drank several hours before this walk to the place where the mysteries took place. But everybody that we think of as the foundation of Western culture, Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras, they all participated in the Eleusinian Mysteries. And women could participate, slaves could participate. It was under pain of death. You couldn't say what happened. And the core of Western culture was intimately interwoven with psychedelic drugs. So cultures and drugs have coexisted for mutual benefit for the millennia. And it was only, again, this Catholic Church, which wanted to monopolize the direct access to spirituality. And we know also that, you know, when the Catholics came into America, when they noticed that some of the Indians were using peyote, they considered that to be from the devil, and they killed and tortured their leaders. And they wanted to replace the church with their hierarchical structure as the intermediary between people and God, people and spirituality. And so, you know, we have a sorry state of estrangement from the physical world, as we see in terms of pollution and global warming, other things. And so these unitive experiences are really key to our cultural survival. So the reintegration of psychedelics and the overturning of prohibition, I think, are really crucial steps towards building a healthier society that can deal with the stresses of the 21st century.
That was from a conversation with Rick Doblin, PhD, the founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Well, that's the overview.
Now, in the coming months, we'll have shows focusing on many aspects of drugs, drug culture, and the influence of drugs on society. Each show will have a different, specific focus. Free Culture Radio is produced here in Portland, Oregon, so you know that means we're going to be talking about beer and brew pubs. We'll have a show about marijuana, a program on heroin, one on coffee and coffee shops. We'll talk harm reduction, we'll talk education and drug consumer safety. All that and much more. You can keep informed and find out about next show by giving our Facebook page a like. It's at facebook.com/KBOO Free Culture Radio. We'll be back in a month, on the third Wednesday of the month, from 6:30 to 7 p.m. here on KBOO. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. KBOO.FM on the web. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
And the time is 6:59, just a few seconds before 7 p.m. You're tuned in to KBOO Portland. This is your Wednesday episode of Hard Knock Radio. And first, we have some community calendar events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Avalon Sanctuary Fundraiser, Saturday, August 27th from 4 to 9 p.m. at 19th and Avalon in Southeast Portland. Avalon Sanctuary is a dead-end street that is being turned into a community green space. The first part of the event will be an open bluegrass jam, and storytellers will share the history of inner Southeast Portland. Again, that's Avalon Sanctuary Fundraiser on Saturday, August 27th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Southeast 19th and Avalon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud